Hello, everybody. It's your host, Jordan Prusciola, and I will do my usual introduction in just a moment here. But first, I wanted to say a huge thank you to everyone who's already become a member of Maximum Fun and decided that they want to support Feeling Seen. I know there are more of you out there, and you should come join us. We are one of the newest shows on the network, and it is just thrilling to know we have people out there who value this podcast and want to see it thrive, because I super do as well. And of course, there will be more on that later. But today's main event is none other than Janet Varney. She is an accomplished actor, real life actor, voice actor, and a major fixture in the California comedy world. Also, a fellow Max Funster. She is just the perfect person to have a one-on-one with during the drawing to the close of Max Fun Drive. We are coming down the final stretch, and we are doing it with JV Club's very own Janet Varney. And then later on in the episode, I will, of course, have one quick thing before I go about the director of the hour, Peter Jackson. And but that's it. Let's wrap up the preamble, and let's get on with the show. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Maximum Fun. I said the network. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Feeling Seen podcast, the podcast that talks about the movies that make us feel seen. And clearly, I'm in a state about our guest being here, I guess, like with me fucking up the name of the podcast that I host, because I've been excited to talk to Janet Varney again, extending our dynamic, I guess, from my appearance on her podcast, The JV Club, yes, which is also a Maximum Fun pod. And I hardly know actually how to introduce you from there, because I feel like you're somebody who does a million things, and it's like work that is visible, work that is invisible, like you're pulling strings, you're coordinating things, you do SF Sketchfest, like, which is, I don't know, are you like the brain trust of that? Like, what is the best way for us to set the listeners up with Janet Varney and the, I don't know, Renaissance woman profile you have?
I think just welcome to Maximum Fun's Janet Varney. We can just say Maximum Fun as much as possible. We're both, I'll tell you, I knew exactly why you said it, which is that we've been thinking a lot about Max Fun Drive, so that it's top of mind, and it's completely understandable. And I do have my podcast, The JV Club, on the Max Fun Network, and your episode is one of my longest. Like, I did not want to stop talking to you. It was clear that I did not want to stop talking to you. It was a very long episode. I loved it.
I'm good at a long conversation.
I absolutely loved it. So I'm very, very happy to be doing your pod. And I'm excited. And I suggested a movie, and you were like, dude, yes.
Yeah, yes, absolutely.
That made me very happy.
And you were like, ooh, this movie? Should we? And so what? Tell the folks at home then what movie and what character you have brought for us to discuss today.
Well, it's just one of those things where, you know, I kind of try not to overthink stuff, because if I do start to think about anything, it becomes an overthink. There's sort of not anything in between. So when Marissa asked, you know, what character I thought I would do, something immediately popped to mind, and I definitely sort of went like, oh, yeah, oh, no, well, yes, but no. So
the whole kombucha girl meme.
The whole kombucha, yeah, exactly right. The movie is Heavenly Creatures. Mm-hmm. Kate Winslet plays Juliet. She is a young woman from England who had many bouts with tuberculosis, including through the film's period of time that it's covering. Melanie Lynskey plays Pauline. She's a sort of modest, lower middle class kid who has had her own issues.
I've got scars. They're on my lungs. I spent months in bed during the war, ravaged by respiratory illness. Mummy and Daddy sent me to the Bahamas to recuperate. I didn't see them for 5 years. But we're together now, and Mummy's promised they'll never leave me again.
I spent ages in hospital too, with my leg. I had to have all these operations. I was osteomyelitis turns your bones to chalk.
They meet together at this public girls' school, and mm-hmm. they just are very drawn to each other. Certainly the way it's depicted in the film, Pauline is very taken with Juliet first, but I think very quickly there's more of there's definitely something they share that infatuation. It doesn't read like one of them is sort of oblivious to the other but allowing her to tag along, or
no, it feels,
you know, whatever.
Reciprocal,
it feels
to
very
me.
Reciprocal and yeah. very protective. They're very protective of each other.
Cheer up. All the best people have bad chests and bone diseases. It's all frightfully romantic.
And so ultimately they do feel that, you know, they are being kept apart by this sort of system, which in their case can be trickled down all the way to mm-hmm. just their parents. And then they sort of find a way to isolate one parent as the primary problem. It's unclear in the film exactly mm-hmm. why. And even in just the research I was doing, it still was kind of unclear to me why they focused in on her.
It's Pauline's mother, correct?
On Pauline's mother, Honora, like spelled like honor with an A at the end, Honora, and they are going to be separated because the reason that Juliet's family moved to Christchurch is that her father was becoming kind of the vice chancellor of Canterbury College there. He was there for a year. They didn't like him. It sounded like he was really conservative, and they actually thought that he was too kind of reductive about the university rather than being more diverse. And then also Juliet's continuing to have problems with tuberculosis. And so there's this idea that she's going to leave New Zealand. She's maybe going to go to South Africa to further treat her TB. Her parents continually just ship her off places or leave her behind. Or they're just used to having this daughter that sometimes is around and sometimes is in the hospital. And so they decide that Paul will go with, you know, the two girls decide Paul's going to have to go with Juliet to South Africa. Mm-hmm. She can't get a passport. She's supposed to have her parents' permission. And it goes from she can't go because she can't get her parents' permission for a passport to, I think if we kill my mother, this will all work out.
Yeah.
Our main idea for the day was to moid a mother. This notion is not a new one, but this time it is a definite plan, which we intend to carry out. We have worked it out carefully and are both thrilled by the idea. Naturally, we feel a trifle nervous, but the pleasure of anticipation is great.
You know, picking a specific character versus kind of looking at elements of the movie overall was challenging, just in the sense of, you know, like many of us, I think one of the things that's so compelling about the relationship between Paul or Pauline or Yvonne, mm-hmm. depending on who's saying her name, and and Juliet or Deborah, depending on who's saying
Deborah. Her name. I love Deborah.
Right? I think one of the things that's compelling about it is that we see, perhaps, or at least I do, see myself in both of those girls, and they're very mm-hmm. different one from the other. So I said Kate Winslet's character because I definitely was more like raise your hand too fast in the classroom than I was like sit in the back pouting. So that's sort of like, that was the criteria that I used to choose Kate Winslet. But you know, it's almost like the relationship itself is the character that, you know, I sort of was like, oh.
I feel like it's a very interesting way of putting it, because like the relationship itself, it is a character on its own within Heavenly Creatures, is based on the story of the Parker Hulme killings in Christchurch, New Zealand, I think in 1954, mid-1950s, where these two teenage girls become enamored of one another. And over the course of the movie, they build this world between one another, and their connection becomes increasingly more intimate, and then it becomes physical. And there is a canonically lesbian desperate longing for one another.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot and a lot of role playing, which I think that was another thing that felt very, very familiar to me was, you know, as a kid, even younger than the girls are in this movie, you know, I was like just doing a lot of making out with girlfriends, and it was all in the guise of let's pretend we're these characters.
Was the introduction of that conceit something that was mutually arrived upon, or did you find that was like, was that brought up to you and you were like, yeah, sounds like a good idea?
I can't remember. I don't remember one of us or the other initiating it. I definitely think there were situations later where like I might have initiated the idea of that because I had done it before.
Interesting.
Now I'm like, oh no, I hope I didn't like do some, make a, like a tiny girlfriend of mine like smooch me when she didn't want to. I don't think any of that happened.
I don't think you did that.
You're now preoccupied with, I gotta go. No, but it was just sort of like, let's play boyfriend girlfriend. I mean, those were the words that we used. And so it's an interesting kind of lens.
I mean, it's literally what she says in Jennifer's Body to Needy. She's like, we can play boyfriend girlfriend.
Yeah, that's like a thing, right? And so, yeah, maybe that came from the outside and it was just part of the like zeitgeist as you're growing up in a very kind of, you know, heteronormative society. But that was a great kind of way to push past whatever you wanted. And I'm sure in some cases there was just sort of a natural curiosity and it was just like, let's play act and see what kissing feels like. And maybe there weren't feelings attached. So that also felt very familiar. And I do not think I'd seen that in any movie before. This idea of I'm this person and you're this person and we're just going to spend two straight nights and days making love to each other in the characters of these people we've created in our fourth world, which is the name of heaven, the non-heaven that they have created, wherein it's not hell, but it is where all the artists and poets and everyone goes.
Daddy says the Bible's a load of bunkum. But we're all going to heaven. I'm not. I'm going to the fourth world. It's sort of like heaven. Only better, because there aren't any Christians. It's an absolute paradise of music, art, and pure enjoyment.
So, you know, it sounds great. It sounds really great. So all of that. And to the idea of still idolizing male figures and incorporating them into your fantasy while also being completely attracted to each other and very, again, in love with and protective of one another. That also felt like very familiar, that they're not mutually exclusive, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I also hadn't watched the movie in a little bit. And, you know, the older you get, the closer you get towards the parents' age.
Right, right. Yeah.
The more you're like, oh, gosh, this is rough. This is rough. But, you know, when I first saw the movie, I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And, I was horrified by what happened.
Of course.
But, you know, what is most exciting about the movie is the relationship and the fact that all of the diary entries that the very, very fine Melanie Lynskey, who I was so starstruck when I can call her a friend, but when I met her, sort of finding out like this was her first real job.
Yeah.
And, you know, the diary entries are all real. Those are all real diary entries from Pauline. And yeah, it's really like, for as fantastical and as imaginative and as intimate as the movie is, he kind of, I mean, it's kind of all there except for afterwards and when they, you know, are interviewed by the police and when they find her diaries and stuff, which is sort of a little, you know, series of chyrons at the end that Peter Jackson does. Like, okay, yeah, and then this and this and this happened. Anyway, let's go to the credits. It's really interesting and it's, I can't imagine how, to me, it would have seemed so intimidating because, you know, New Zealand's a small country and this was kind of the most famous crime that had occurred there.
Right.
And if you're not, unless you're talking about like ruining Indigenous people's lives, but anyway, it's cool.
Right. Sure. Unless we're talking about system-wide state sanctioned.
That's correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
The most individuated white person crime.
Well, I would imagine like I would, like you said, with like especially like at the time in the say the mid-century with the size of that country, kind of I would imagine takes on the scope of something like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Totally. Like totally great
where it
comparison.
Becomes like the face of madness is.
Yes.
And it becomes 100%. This like Leopold and Loeb the size of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
100%. And also, like, you know, the context of it, boy, it also feels, especially for that era, like it probably would have done the same thing if it was in Lawrence, Kansas. Like it probably would have done the same thing and would have been known across the United States, frankly.
Well, especially like two girls, something that
two girls
scandalous.
Who may or may not have been up to some hanky panky behind closed doors. Our girls. You know what I mean?
Those girls are up to something in the bathroom. I think they're taking photographs of each other.
Just leave them alone, Henry.
I'm prepared to tolerate that Reaper girl's presence, but I will not stand for any, you know, hanky-panky.
I'm sure it's all perfectly innocent.
And again, he does a great job of really showing his interpretation of both of their isolations, that their respective isolations and their health problems, and he sets it up so nicely for, you know, there could only be in this small community, like the chance that the two found each other.
Yeah.
It feels very romantic. So it's really, it's tough. It's a tough watch because you kind of feel for everybody. And that's an uncomfortable place to be.
Well, it does have this, the sort of desperate, destined connection between Paul and Deborah, these genderqueer in persona teens.
Yeah.
It feels like Romeo and Juliet in its sort of all-consuming scope.
Yeah.
But it's instead of them taking their own lives, they are driven to madness and they take the lives of one of their mothers, of Pauline's mom. And even in that quality of like its dreaminess, the way that Peter Jackson is so like Peter Jackson's a great director, we know this, but early Peter Jackson, there is such a, like, you get such an incredible sense of his taste for the fantastic. And in this, too, like, the fantasy scenes where we see them as, like, crowned queens, like, cheersing with one another with goblets of wine and wearing, like, capes.
Yes.
I like the creation of this world that is so complete that it feels like they really are apart in another dimension almost with one another because that is what that sort of all-consuming codependency takes on with another person, especially when you're fucking teenagers.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It really, I mean, and it's hard not to want to use the like folie à deux thing because this feels like sort of the classic kind of, what's interesting about, because I feel like folie à deux, which means, I'm sure everyone knows this, but it just means like the crazy that comes, was born of two people. You know, in a lot of those cases, people will be talking about adults, like adult real life true crime cases where there's this folie à deux. And usually it's like this one person was very magnetic and kind of plotted everything. And the other one was sucked into that kind of vortex.
Yeah.
And so that's usually how, it, at least in my encounters of it, it's used. And it almost feels more right when it's two totally underdeveloped brain-wise, hormonal young women who both experience this tremendous isolation, you know, have they each have sort of weird abandonment issues or, you know, identity issues. And not that that part's weird, but and then to find each other and like if you are a kid who was isolated or who was like sort of trapped in your own body in any period of time through an illness, your imagination goes crazy. I mean, if you're lucky, frankly, it goes crazy. And and I mean crazy in the most loving, wonderful, appreciative way.
Yeah.
Because you become so adept at world building. And if you're a smart kid, you find ways to use that to your advantage. And so having two people who both of whom have this rich imagination and kind of awakening it even more in each other feels like, oh no, they went down this road together. Like they really went down this road together and it's really intoxicating. It's really intoxicating.
Only the best people fight against all obstacles in pursuit of happiness.
Well, I think like that, just in the sense of that, like, what isolation breeds. Like there was that documentary from a few years ago, The Wolf Pack, that was that family, that collection of brothers who basically never left their apartment, like in New York City. And they, like, this documentary is made about them because they are devoted film fans.
Yeah.
And they do elaborate like recreations of cinema they've memorized.
Yeah.
Because they have to build a world that's bigger than the one that they're inside of.
Yeah.
Otherwise, You either, I feel like, fully go astray of your faculties and start sort of like losing grip on things, or you're like, okay, I'm going to have the most rich imagination that a human being could possibly have, and I'm going to live within a bubble of fantasy oftentimes that to other people would seem even probably impossible to create. But right. I am so encapsulated here. The world as it exists around me, I would imagine, is either like so uninviting or so scary or so impossible to reach that it becomes your only option. Like it.
Yes.
You know what? I'm not saying it was rational, but I am saying I see the straight line.
Yes.
For how 100%. They got to where they were.
100%.
Well, a thing I think I do want to ask you then. So like when did you see this in the 90s? Did you see this around
when it came out? I saw this movie when it came out.
Was this movie unique to other things you had seen with its presentation of like this relationship between these girls? Or did you, because this is also the 90s, a fascinating time for a queer killers and erotic thrillers.
I know. There's so many
dangerous bisexual girls.
I know.
Who will fuck your dad and you and your mom and your boyfriend.
It really was. It was like, it's such an interesting period of time because in many ways, I mean, there's stuff that definitely, I mean, a few years ago for Pride Month, I was like, oh, let me just like list, I'll just do, you know, on Instagram, I'll list like 10 movies that had, you know, queer characters or, you know, experimentally queer, whatever characters, because you're so hungry for that when you're a young person. And that was an era in which I was a child into being a teenager. And I was so hungry for that. I mean, I loved Basic Instinct. Loved Poison Ivy. I loved Wild Things. Uh-huh. I loved Henry and June. I loved like any, and most of it was
Alicia Silverstone's entire early filmography up to the point of Batman and Robin. Like,
but yeah, I mean, I was looking for that, not because I wanted to see a bunch of, you know, bisexual girls kill someone, but I think it did feel like progress in some, you know, in some way. It felt like, well, at least I'm seeing something.
Something.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And if you're looking at this as a metaphor, if you sort of can twist it into a metaphor of like, you know, the sort of danger that society feels about this fluidity, then you can sort of, like, you can reverse the harmful stereotype and turn it into like, aha, but really this is just a big metaphor and there's nothing wrong with what's happening, but it has to be depicted in this way where they're crazy and are killing people because that's just holding a mirror up to society, man.
Right. Well, becomes the thing of like, do you, like in the history of queer presence in horror, it's like, do you see yourself in the hero or the monster? And in seeing yourself in the monster, is it because you identify with like wanting to have the power to destroy, or because you feel a resonance with the marginalized outcast character who, and if you do, there becomes a lot of like emotional connection in the idea of someone fighting back against everything around them that tells them they can't be what they are.
Exactly.
We are going to take a quick break, but we will be back with more Janet Varney. Lucky you. Tomorrow is the last day of the drive, the Maximum Fun Drive. You're all very sad about it. So now is your chance to make that pledge, make that little pledge, make that big pledge, not only to this show, but to a community of listeners that care about other people and the world around them and want their podcasts to reflect those values. Vote with your dollars. Vote for us. That might sound grandiose, but there are a lot of entertainment companies that we throw $5, $10, or even $20 at each month that make us feel not so good about paying them and supporting their titanic multinational corporate ambitions. If we give them even a moment's extra bit of thought, Maximum Fun is not one of those companies. It's a company that you can feel good about supporting. It's a company that I feel great about being a part of. What's more, 70% of your money goes directly to the shows that you say you listen to. You have a direct impact. You make a difference. The dollars go straight to where you want them to support, which is awesome. And that is why you want to go. I know you want to. you need to and you want to go to maximumfun.org/join and hit that feeling seen checkbox. Give the movement a groundswell of momentum. We are insurgent. We are passionate. We are not going anywhere. And we have many feelings. And I want us all to share them together. So the last day of the drive, Maximum Fun Drive, ends on Friday, May 6th. You could do it tomorrow, but we're running out of tomorrows on the Max Fun Drive. So just go do it right now. Do it today. Go support Maximum Fun. MaximumFun.org/join. I've been talking with the one and only Janet Varney about the one and only Heavenly Creatures, directed by Peter Jackson, who also co-wrote the movie with his wife and constant collaborator, screenwriter Fran Walsh. Let's get back to that conversation. And because you're a thoughtful individual that I've already had a conversation with before, I wanted to bring like a thought experiment question here. Mm. There was a number of years ago at this point. It was on the 60th anniversary of Ingrid Bergman's movie Persona. Emily Yoshida wrote a wonderful essay for Vulture, recognizing the anniversary of the movie and talking about how it existed in the cinematic tradition of men being afraid of women alone together. Mm-hmm. And there, with, you know, given the domination of behind the camera work by men, male directors instead of female directors throughout time. And I think Peter Jackson handles this very well. I love this movie.
I think he loves those girls. And I also feel like his relationship with Fran Walsh, I feel he has a very feminine...
Who he wrote the movie with.
I think he and Fran are sort of a single person, mm-hmm, in the way that they work intellectually and artistically together. And so, yeah, I feel like you really feel... You feel that. You feel the femininity in it, and you feel, yeah, the sort of tenderness for them in that way.
And so with this is like, this is this movie is kind of a tangent off that category, but I just sort of wanted to ask you for your thoughts generally about that. Like, what is it about women alone together that just seems to possibly scare men, yeah, so much to the point of making so much art about how crazy we're going to fucking get? Yeah. Without supervision.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of it is this sort of, again, I'm not excusing sexism because why would I? But yeah, this sort of understood idea going all the way back to what, like Lysistrata or whatever. Whatever was the Greek play where the women withhold sex from the men so that they don't go to war?
Lysistrata.
There has long been this idea in straight culture that, like, women are the ones running things. And yeah, so, like, maybe the upshot of that is that, you know, part of that, and in some men's point of view, is just a natural exploration of already knowing that's what's happening. Uh-huh. And what if it were just overt and, like, out there? Mm-hmm. Or what if, you know, it was allowed to be carried to whatever the metaphorically frightening level would be?
Uh-huh.
But also there is that titillation too, right? It's like, ugh, yeah, you know, not only am I terrified by them, but what if I'm also excited by what's happening there? And what if I'm not necessary? What if they don't need me? What if they don't need me? What if they?
What if everything
they're getting is fine? And like, I'm pointless.
Works.
Yeah.
What if they're just good on that island?
That's really scary. I think that can be very scary. And that was certainly, I mean, that's something that remains. And again, I have a lot of empathy for, you know, I've never been in a relationship with, I've certainly been in relationships with women where they continued to have feelings for men and, mm-hmm, wanted to act on those feelings. And I've been that person. I have never been with a gentleman or male identifying person who also felt they could be honest with me about continuing to be attracted to other men. So, mm, I've never confronted that. Mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm, because it would be new for me, I can't say if I would feel jealousy. I feel like I've sort of gotten to work through what it means in those other contexts, but I don't know what would happen if my male partner said, you know, I love you, you're my soulmate, I absolutely do have, you know, I would love to explore some of these feelings I'm having. I don't know. I would love to say that I'm so woke that I would be like, go for it, baby. Like, I'll be imagining your penis rubbing against another penis. Like, I wish.
Yeah. I wish I knew it could be me.
But I think I would feel a sense of sort of like, oh no, a thing I don't have, I can't offer. Right. Like, I think that might happen.
I assume that would happen with, I would be sad that I didn't have all the things.
Yeah, and again,
it wouldn't be like a resentment or if it would just be like, oh fuck,
yeah,
that's just out you of that's out, that's out of my yeah. you got me. There's not like a way I can better myself to change that circumstance.
Yeah,
like, communication on my part isn't gonna fix that.
Right, right. You know, it's just it's entirely different. You don't because of where the power sits and has sat. You know, you don't, like, who knows if women were, if we had been a matriarchal society, maybe there would be a ton of like really like tawdry movies about gay men, about like what happens when you leave men to their own devices.
The erotic thriller wave of the 90s. Yeah. And there's like, men and men.
Yes. The women at the helm of like, and then they just adopted a baby and they robbed a bank. And then I never saw them again.
and then their male nanny started having sex with the husband.
That's right.
And it's like, let's just
chaos.
The answer to the dearth of erotic thrillers is to let's just gender swap them all and see what happens.
That's right. It's not an experiment I would hate. I think I might really appreciate that.
How do you feel about like the queer villainy? Like, because there's the reality that the villains are like the funnest, most cool characters to play.
Yeah.
And then there's the reality, too, that like queerness is aligned with danger and threat.
Psychopathy. And, like, let's just call it what it is. I mean, I think it's often aligned with mental illness and psychopathy. And that feels like a piece on a continuum. And I'm done with that piece. Like, I can be nostalgic for that piece.
Yeah.
And those movies, there's just, as we have established in this episode, there's a lot of them. We're good.
So many.
I kind of feel like we're good.
We'll
always have those. You can completely have that. But I feel like we've harvested all of that. And I think it's time to, and we have been, but like, I'm eager for there to be more and more content that in which that sexuality or that queerness is a little more incidental. That doesn't mean that important films can't or shouldn't be made purely about the experience of being queer, of course, but also it's just okay to like have a movie in which, you know, someone is poly and it's not like they're not also a psychopath. Because because a high sex drive, that's what it's associated with, is a high sex drive. Like, oh, if you know what I mean?
Libidinous femme fatale.
Yes, in particular bisexuality or general sort of polyamory is sort of, you know, like if you're that attracted to that many people, probably there's something going on there. Like, you have a really high adrenaline threshold and a high dopamine threshold, and you just want to have sex all the time, you know?
There's probably something going on there.
And they're
might
really
want to get checked out.
Yeah, and there is like that's something that's kind of highlighted with, you know, you sort of hear that in the whispers of crime as well. Like, this person, you know, it's because they were closeted, and so they had a wife, but they really also wanted to have sex with men, but actually they liked having sex with their wife because they were a psychopath. They liked having sex with everyone. Therefore, do you know what I mean? And so I think those things got linked early on in kind of modern psychiatry, and you know, and being homosexual was, you know, in the big old book of what can be wrong with you.
Yeah.
And, you
know,
let's put that in the DSM. And so, you know, those things are still, I think we just have to work harder to pull them apart, because they're still associated with each other kind of a lot, considering that it's 2022 and how much and how wonderful stuff is happening all the time, kind of advancing the way we see queerness. I think that's kind of a lingering thing that is maybe still a problem. What do you think?
Well, I'm so mad at the amount of time spent stigmatizing queerness and aligning it with villainy so as to create a pejorative association automatically,
right,
between a queer person in a villainous role, to where to have somebody be a queer villain in something now, it can't just be a fun thing on its own necessarily. It comes with a fucking century of baggage.
Right.
In cinema, where it's like, I can't divorce myself from the fact that, like, a killer, it's still hard for me in my mind for a killer to just happen to be gay, perhaps.
Right.
Because it's attached to this long tradition,
right,
of associating that queerness intrinsically,
right,
with what is broken in them and what is evil. And I'm really fucking pissed about it because I want all villains to be queer because that's the best part.
I know.
I want every villain I love to be queer because you're going to chew the screen more than anybody else. You're going to be the one people are talking about. You're going, right, to be the fucking icon. We don't talk about Basic Instinct because
nobody's talking about Michael Douglas and Basic
Instinct.
Nobody is talking about Michael Douglas.
No, but we're not talking about Fatal Attraction because, yeah, Glenn Close was a runner-up in that movie. Like,
right.
No, we talk about these movies. I love The Crush.
Yeah.
Because Alicia Silverstone is so fucking magnetic in, like, the, yeah, first role of her career.
Yeah.
But I'm like, that is a movie star showing out.
Yeah.
And,
yep,
so, like, I just, it pisses me off.
No, I completely get it. I know. I completely get it.
To divorce ourselves.
That's why I'm saying, like, we got to get to the equilibrium. We got to get to the equilibrium where,
yes,
we can be in a place where it doesn't have to be purely incidental, but it doesn't mean anything societally that we have to worry about, mm-hmm, when there's a fucking awesome, sexy, brilliant villain in,
yeah,
a movie who's queer. Like, it doesn't mean, like, oh no, it's a vilification of the concept with a giant C. You know, it's,
yeah,
that it that it can just be enjoyable and give you that same rush that you get from loving a really good villain. Absolutely. I completely understand what you're saying, for sure.
I wanted to ask about, like, when you saw this movie and you know, if there was, like, a resonant connection with you and these characters, this, you know, particularly Kate in this movie, was it a welcome sort of sense of recognition?
Yes.
Or was it, it was like, oh, good, thank God. It wasn't like, oh, I'm connecting in ways where I'm like,
no,
oh,
not
shit
at all. Like, I don't think, well, that's the
thing.
I don't
know where you were at in your, like, queerness journey.
No, that's a great question. I never worried that my feelings were dangerous. I never worried I definitely felt like, and even when I was that age, frankly, I wish I could say that I was so self-aware or so societally aware that,
right,
I was worried about all of these, like, dangerous queer characters happening. I think I was just like, I'm in heaven. Like, I don't think I was thinking past the fact that this was happening at all. And that's
my
honest, you know, I mean, again, I was a kid. So I definitely didn't feel that way. And, you know, I mean, this, again, to be in an age where, you know, you, like, many of us are sort of flirting with, you know, I did all of the stuff right around the same time. Queerness in film has been a forever for me. There's no, like, that's just always.
Okay.
But certainly as a teenager, you know, I definitely went through the, like, you know, and still actually totally love, like, the goth phase and, you know, the sort of, like, I'm wearing a dog collar for me, not for you. And so, you know, I was super into A Clockwork Orange, and I certainly was not experiencing it as a literal, like, oh, he's hurting a poor little old lady. Like, it was way high art in my mind. And I wasn't, because I was an empathetic kid. I was not like, oh, in real life, if you did this, like, you'd be a monster. I just wasn't looking at it that way. And that was
adrenaline
rush.
That's the fun
rush
of watching things when you're little, is that you just kind of, like, my first movie memory is of watching Hellraiser. And I was probably 5.
Oh, boy.
And
that,
it was just fucking cool.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not thinking about pain as pleasure and pleasure as pain and, like, what hell means and why it's erotic that Frank's, like, all, like, pulled apart by hooks and stuff. I'm just like, Cenobites are fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Like, a skeleton just came out of a blood pile in the attic. This is amazing. Yeah. And it's there's something so special about being able to, like, even watching, and I don't think Hellraiser is problematic. It's just, like, super kinky. Yeah. Like, it, there's something very special about the naive period of your life when you can watch problematic things and just take them at face value.
Oh my God, absolutely, absolutely.
And be absolutely. Like, oh, I'll, later I'm going to unpack
yeah.
everything about that. Yeah. But right now, I'm just kind of going to be like, later I'm going to be like, RoboCop is a satire of state violence. But right. when I'm little, I just get to be like, RoboCop fucking rules.
Correct. Correct. But yeah, so this, so I felt, I definitely felt seen by this movie. I definitely, I was very troubled that they do kill Honora, and I didn't, and I still don't. From a, like, can I put myself in the shoes of these girls place? I can't yeah. wrap my head around it. But yes, from a sort of metaphorical, like, you don't want things to keep you. And also in a very literal way, I had a friend that I was desperately in love with, that I wanted to sleep in the same bed with every night, that we, you know, it was like part of that language was we each could date the same person. And it wouldn't make it. Would it would be like you could date either one of us, and it would be like dating the same person,
right?
And, which
right,
is sort
yeah.
this way that you're sort of navigating your sexuality in those times when you have these very intimate relationships that kind of bleed over one into, you know, whether they're platonic or not. And her mom at some point was like, I don't think this is good. Like, yeah. I definitely would like our daughters to, like, I think she talked to my dad and was uh-huh. like, I feel that they shouldn't spend less time together. I don't think they're good for each other. I don't think they're good influences on each other. And my dad was like, like, I'm not worried about it. And so, you know, we did have this sort of, like, you know, fuck your mom.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
she doesn't get it and she never will. So on a literal level, I did understand that. That being said, I certainly didn't carry it into any kind of fantasy of, like, ending the life of you know, my friend's mom.
No.
But again, when you're a teenager, you can you sort of have the, like, oh, thank you for that catharsis of this thing happening. But it doesn't end happily. It's not like it, you know. That's
no.
the other thing is that you don't. It's they don't. And he could have... You could sort of see, because of the way the movie is written and shot and everything you were talking about with its how stylized it is, you could sort of see him decide, he and Fran deciding to have them
oh, yeah.
sort of fade into their world and sort of
that would have made
imply,
total sense
like,
for Peter
they're
Jackson.
Just going to have to, she's going to have to just, like, disappear into that place, and because
yeah.
they're both going to prison in separate places, so
yeah.
they're just going to have to live in their heads even more and sort of and leave you with that feeling of, like, we'll always have each other. And you don't. You feel like they got torn apart. You feel like the thing that they were trying to prevent, they just guaranteed was going to happen. And it's heartbreaking. And it's, you know, you see them. She's leaving on a steamer ship that in this sort of sepia fantasy that we've seen earlier in the movie,
yeah.
they're together on that ship. And now she's leaving, and they're both, and it's, again, so stylized. They're both just crying. You can tell that it's ADR, that it's not, and it's not about Mel matching her lip flaps with her crying. It is
yeah.
this echoey, screaming horror feeling that these two girls are having, and and it's really upsetting. It's really upsetting.
I love what this movie does to honor how big and catastrophic and life-ending. I can't speak to being a teenage boy because I never was one, but, like, how that feels when you're a teenage girl and when your life changes in a big way, could be even in a moderate way, but in a big way, and maybe this person that you just need
yeah.
for some reason is, like, it is they could be moving a town away,
yeah,
and they might as well be getting on that fucking steamship.
Absolutely.
And I love when things give the gravity of the apocalypse to the emotional experiences of teenage girls.
It's so important, and it's important because, you know, and this movie reminds us of that because of the era in which this all took place, is, like, the less you acknowledge that exists, the more dangerous it becomes, because that is when kids commit suicide. That is when you feel like there's, like, when something has shattered you to that point, it does feel like there's nothing past this. I don't feel like there's anything past this. And in order to be able to talk about it and in order to be able to ideally show up for those young people and be and find a way in a language to say, I both 100% know what you're feeling and it is real. And I also need to take you to the other side of this. Please let me or let us or let someone take you to the other side of this because you will be okay. Yeah. And some kids don't get that messaging and they do take their lives. And, you know, that you, this kind of thing is it's like I mean, it's so important to honor that, Jordan. I completely agree with you. It's so important to honor that. And I think the where it gets tricky is people worry that honoring that is deifying it versus, no, we just need a language to talk about this that doesn't minimize the intensity of that, because that's a mistake. That's not going to get you where you need to be with teenagers like I was, who felt like my world was ending. Having that be minimized would just send me further into isolation rather than feeling seen.
Well, then my final question to you would be to give us a levity on the way out. What is something that has brought you like queer joy lately? What's a queer joy uplift that we should send people off with?
That's a great question. Oh my gosh, I'm so bad at thinking about things on the
No, and this is like, this is one of those most rude questions. It's like, tell me your favorite movies on the spot, go. And you're like, I've never seen a movie.
Hi,
I don't have
an answer. MASH. I play MASH and I cannot play MASH on the other side in any way. I'm just trying to think of what sort of is just joyful. Yeah, okay. Sex Education. Sex Education is a great, I love that show. I love everything it's doing. It's so joyful. But it doesn't pull its punches in terms of that emotional feeling of being a teenager. It tackles some really tough stuff, but there's a sweetness and a lightness to it that it always returns to. So it's sort of stasis, like it's you know its equilibrium is like to kind of come back to this place of like total joy and celebration. And there's plenty of queer joy that's part of that, and it's great.
Excellent. If you guys haven't seen Heavenly Creatures, it's not the easiest movie to find. So either just buy.
I had to rewatch it with Spanish subtitles on YouTube.
it's either like you can on go sight unseen, buy a copy and own it because it's very a great special. Movie. I checked the Los Angeles Public Library system and I could not find a copy of
this. Love that you did that though. I love that you did that because they could. They've got a lot. Shout out to the library
the
book by
I
Susan Orlean.
Like, yeah. But find Heavenly Creatures and then also treat yourself to the uplift after the ubiquitously available Sex Education because that's a Netflix program.
That's right, baby.
Thank you so much, Janet, for bringing joy and your intellect to this conversation. I really, really like talking to you.
I love talking to you. I knew that we were both just going to have all of our synapses firing, and I'm floating on a high from it. I love talking to you. I talk to you about anything, but particularly stuff like this. I just love it.
I'm really happy about it. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Me too. Thanks for listening, everybody. And maximum fun, maximum fun, maximum fun.
Yeah, max fun. Pledge drive, pledge drive, pledge drive. Janet Varney, guys, if you're listening out there, give a round of applause to yourself for Janet Varney. I loved being on her show. I love that she wanted to come on to mine. It makes me feel special and it makes me feel popular. And now, of course, I've got that one quick thing before I go. And I just wanted to touch on Peter Jackson. Obviously, this is a tuned in audience. The Max Fun listeners are people who are in the know. But I find it does tend to slip past people that Peter Jackson, the man who brought the great Lord of the Rings trilogy to life in such spectacular fashion, his humble beginnings in New Zealand are as a horror director, a kind of trash horror director. That's obviously not what Heavenly Creatures is. That is not trash cinema. But movies like Bad Taste and Dead Alive are spectacles of outlandish practical effects, dripping, oozing gore, kind of maniacal, good-natured violence and thrills. And I encourage everybody to go find those early movies. Check them out. Heavenly Creatures, obviously wonderful. Obviously pretty hard to find. Dead Alive and Bad Taste, go hit those up. And we mentioned it in this conversation. The Frighteners. The Frighteners is one of my like low-key MVP scary movies of all time. I think it's one of the best things Michael J. Fox has ever done. The effects, even now when you watch it, they hold up really well. It is, and it points to some of the effects hold up really well. Some of them are so kind of their era. They're charming. It's fucked up. It is goofy. It is kind of off the rails. And that is exactly what I think of when I think of early Peter Jackson horror. So go expand your Jackson palette. See what the, you know, famous steward of the Hobbits did before he got a gajillion dollars to render one of the most well-realized fantasy films/series of all time onto the screen. Go check out those little beginnings, because I always like to know an origin story. You got a little, you got your Melanie Lynskey and you got your Kate Winslet and Heavenly Creatures doing sublime work. So go check some of the other hidden talents out in his earlier filmography. I think you'll have a really fun time. It's gross out kind of stuff, but it's also like in its way family friendly. The Frighteners was a house favorite in the Cruciola house. We loved it. We had the holographic VHS sleeve cover for our movie, and I would pick it up and I would, you know, what is that called? Like lenticular image. And I would like, you know, hold it back, you know, hold it, sway it back and forth so I could see little Frightener face on the cover. Go check it out. It's a good time. Subscribe to Maximum Fun, as always. This is the last time of the year that I'm going to ask you that. So listen to me one more time. The URL is MaximumFun.org/join. And those are your marching orders for today. As we request your assistance in existing and making really cool stuff that makes you and us very happy. So that is our show. You can follow us on Twitter at FeelingSeenPod. Or join our Facebook group at www.facebook.com/groups/feelingscenepod. You can also send us an email at feelingscene@maximumfun.org. If you want to follow me, I'm JorCrew on Twitter. Our theme music is by Andrew Epen. The show is produced by Marissa Flaxbart. Our senior producers are Kevin Ferguson and Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.